This is Paul Fromm in Washington, D.C. for Radio Freedom. I'm interviewing people attending the Barnes Review Conference on the First Amendment and on history. I'm speaking with one of the men who has single-handedly changed the way many people think about one of the central events of the 20th century, namely the so-called Holocaust. And certainly the discoveries of this one man have absolutely stood on its head the Hollywood version of the events of the Second World War. And I'm talking with Fred Leuchter.
Hello, this is Fred Leuchter here.
Fred traveled to the concentration camps of Auschwitz and several others in the mid-1980s and did some scientific studies, which the results of which basically have turned on its head the accepted the Hollywood version of the Second World War. So I'd like to ask you, Mr. Leuchter, how you got involved in this line of study.
I designed and manufactured execution equipment here in the United States, used in the prison for executing criminals. As an expert witness, I had testified in a number of the courts in the United States and was and still am the only approved witness to testify in federal court relative to execution technology and execution technology. And based on that, I was asked to be an expert witness for the court in Toronto in the second trial of Ernst Zundel. In that capacity, I was given information on the alleged gas chambers at Auschwitz, Birkenau, and Majdanek. And I was sent to Poland to investigate the facilities. I investigated the three locations. I brought forensic samples back, which were reviewed by a chemical lab, and the end result was that none of the facilities that I examined had any gas residue, and there would have been a great deal of gas residue based on the residue that I found in the delousing chamber. And as far as the actual facilities, none of them, in my opinion, were capable of sustaining a gas execution. It would have been a situation where it would be somebody like using their average living room to execute someone, and they'd wind up killing themselves, their family, and half the street. So essentially, that's how I became involved.
What year was it that you went over to Poland and did the scientific studies in Auschwitz and Majdanek?
It was 1988.
So just to clarify for those of us that are not terribly scientific in our backgrounds, you took samples from the walls of what were alleged to be the gas chambers.
Yes, I removed samples from the walls of all locations that were alleged to have been homicidal gas execution chambers. I also removed several control samples from one of the delousing facilities at Birkenau. The blue staining from the cyanide was visible both on the inside and outside walls because the cyanide gas goes right through the structure. None of the blue staining was visible in any of the areas that were allegedly the homicidal gas chambers. And after removing samples and the samples were tested, we found high concentrations of cyanide residue in the delousing samples, but there was absolutely nothing in the areas that were alleged to be homicidal gas chambers. And based on the numbers that the Holocaust experts give us, we should have found anywhere from 50 to 100 times the gas in those samples.
So the delousing chambers were used to delouse what, clothes?
Yes, the delousing chambers were the approximate size of the average walk-in closet. Maybe four people or five people could fit in the closet, so it certainly wasn't big enough to be used as a gas execution chamber. And there was a door on both sides, and there was a rod at the top. There was a dirty side, much like we did in the moon program when we brought the moon rocks and the astronauts back. They went into one side of an area, which was the dirty side, went through the door. The door was closed. They were cleansed. In this case, they would be deloused with hydrogen cyanide gas. The gas would be then pumped up, and it'd open up the door on the other side, and the clothes would just be taken out from the other side. So the clothes would be put in from one side. The door would be closed. The disinfection would take place, the gas would be pumped, and then the second door would be opened and remove the clothes. But they were very small facilities.
So the chambers that were were believed to be used for execution, the gas chambers. When you studied the stones and the mortar on the walls, you didn't find the sort of residue of Cyclone B that was found in the delousing chambers. And so what would be the conclusion that you testified to?
Well, the basic conclusion is that these areas were not used for gas execution facilities. We didn't find even enough residue to indicate that they were fumigated, and they should have been fumigated at least twice a year, according to international health standards set up by the Red Cross. But additionally, I had examined the facilities also from a mechanical standpoint to make a determination if they could be used as gas execution chambers, and none of them had proper seals. The gas would have leaked out. None of them had proper equipment to handle the gas. All of the delousing facilities and the homicidal gas chambers should have been the same way. The gas that was used was boiled off or sublimated from Zyklon B, which were chalk pellets that the hydrogen cyanide gas was dissolved in. And in order to get the gas out, you have to put them in a stove. The pellets are heated up, and then hot air is blown through, and the air is then conducted to the chamber. Now, these stoves were available, and you could see where they were in the delousing facilities, or at least where they were removed. But when you looked at the homicidal gas chambers, there were no windows, there were no doors, there were no openings. There were just... The facilities that I looked at were actually morgues, and that's what was called out on the blueprint, and that's what they appeared to have been, because there weren't even openings that were closed up that they could have had vents in, or they could have had the stove in. There was just nothing there in the way of gas producing or handling hardware.
Did I understand you correctly to say that had these execution chambers being used with Cyclone B, that the persons dropping these pellets in would have ended up gassing themselves?
Yes, that's correct. The way that they were allegedly used were that there were openings in the roof, and a cover was removed, and an SS officer would be standing on a roof, would reach in, pick out the pellets in his hand, and throw them down the hole. They would drop on the floor, and somehow the gas would then come out and kill whoever was in there. Of course, they didn't make any provision for the fact that that there was no heat at all in these buildings, so you couldn't sublimate the gas. But the SS officer on the roof that would be handling the pellets, he would certainly be killing himself, because the heat from his body would be taking some of the gas out of the chalk pellets. So there was also no way of removing the gas, assuming you could get gas into the facility in the first place. The areas were cold. There was no heat at all to heat up the gas, and certainly the number of people that they would allege, and they've alleged that if you have a room full of people, it's going to heat up the area enough. It's certainly not going to heat it up enough to move the gas from one end or from the center, wherever it was, to the walls. And if you did do it this way, in addition to killing yourself at the same time, you'd probably only kill people near the pellets, because they would fall on it and no gas would ever be sublimated and get to the rest of the room. So the facilities were just totally impractical to be used for gas execution facilities.
So thus, one of the key stories in the account of the alleged mass execution of perhaps 6 million Jews in the Second World War completely collapses.
Yes, it does. And there's also the other story about the so-called Sonderkommando, which were special inmates within the prison that were tasked with removing the alleged bodies after the alleged executions. And we have descriptions and drawings of these people handling cadavers, carrying them out of the gas execution chamber, eating sandwiches, smoking cigarettes. And of course, we know this is impossible. We execute people in the United States in gas chambers. After the execution, and the chamber is vented from 15 minutes to a half hour, and that's a small chamber. It only takes one man. The chamber has to be thoroughly washed down with the ammonia or with Clorox bleach to neutralize the cyanide gas, which coats a chamber. Additionally, the inmate who was executed, his clothes, and usually he's just wearing shorts and maybe a T-shirt, those are burned because of the high concentration of the gas, and his entire body has to be washed with ammonia or Clorox bleach before he's turned over to the undertaker, because if we didn't, the undertaker probably would get sick and die. So it's very, the people that are executed have to be handled very carefully, as well as the gas does.
So if the story that we're told had occurred of inmates being tasked to remove the bodies right after the execution with gas, the story would have to have a part two, that these prisoners would be dropping like flies within a few hours.
Yes, and probably after 2 or 3 days of the executions, the SS would have wiped itself out, so there would have been no one left to conduct the executions.
Ladies and gentlemen, you can see why our guest on Radio Freedom is one of those rare individuals whose discoveries have overturned one of the key ideas of our time, and that is that that the Nazis homicidally dispatched 6 million Jews during the Second World War. This is Paul Fromm for Radio Freedom. I'm talking to Fred Lutcher. I'd like to move ahead in history. In 1988, you testified at the second Zündel trial, and you tabled your absolutely myth-shattering information and findings. What did you do next?
I was asked to go to Europe the following year, and I visited some of the other alleged gas execution facilities. I visited Mauthausen in Austria. I visited Dachau. Both of these facilities have now been determined, and had been at that time been determined by the experts, not to have been used. Yet when we go to Dachau, we still see the sign that says gas chamber, even though all of the Holocaust proponents will say that there was never a gas execution conducted there. The interesting thing about that place is that hydrogen cyanide gas is extremely explosive. This is one of the things that if you had people walking around in the gas chamber when you're running gas in, and somebody had a nail on a hobnail boot and they made a spark, it'd blow the gas chamber apart. This is why we strap our inmates down in the United States when we execute them. The interesting thing about the Dachau facility, additionally, is that there are high pressure, uninsulated steam lines directly above the alleged gas chamber. And assuming that the gas chamber we used, there's an air vent in it, because the room was actually a shower and the air vent was used to take the steam out. If you used it for gas execution, we could then suck the gas out directly over the high-pressure steam lines and blow the entire building apart. So I think the German SS was a little smarter than to build execution facilities that would wind up in their own death and exploding their own buildings.
After you'd visited the concentration camps in Eastern Europe twice, were your findings ever published?
Well, they were published by Ernst Zündel at the time of the trial and after the trial. And as I say, originally, my work with them extended only to supplying the court with the actual signed document that I generated after the investigation. I subsequently was asked by Ernst Zündel if I could testify in a German court, and I went to Munich, and I underwent 3 hours of cross-examination by three German judges who, based on the fact that I knew my material and also based on the fact that I was the only person approved in the U.S. courts to testify on execution facilities, that I would be competent to testify on the alleged gas chambers that the Nazis allegedly used in Poland. I was to come back a year later. But prior to that happening, I was asked to appear on a German television show. And I went to Munich to appear on the show, and it turned out that it was only a ruse, because I had spoken almost a year earlier to a group of college professors and high school teachers and historians in Weinheim. And I wasn't aware of the fact, but they had sworn out a criminal complaint for defaming the memory of the dead. I was accosted by three police officers who came from Mannheim, which was the county seat, I guess, for Weinheim, and I was told that I would have to accompany them back to face the judge in trial. And I asked them if I was under arrest, and they said no, I wasn't under arrest. And I said, then I'm not going back. And I was informed that we're going to take you back by force. It turns out that they had no warrant. I was taken in the middle of the night across three state lines in Germany, violating their own laws, and brought up before a judge, who, when I appeared the next morning with an attorney, didn't want to hear anything, but just put me in Mannheim prison. I spent 7 weeks in the prison. I was held mostly in solitary confinement because they were afraid that somebody was going to try to kill me. I had two strikes against me because, number one, I was mocked to death by the Jewish organizations. But I probably wasn't liked by many of the other inmates because I made execution equipment. And prisoners normally don't like people either in law enforcement or make devices that are used to kill them. But over that 7 weeks, my attorney worked to get me a bail hearing. And subsequently, I did get a bail hearing. I appeared at the bail hearing, and the three judges listened and turned the bail down. Well, they ordered the bailiff or the court officer to handcuff me again. They were going to take me back to court. And I asked my lawyer what kind of kangaroo court that this was. I was unaware of the fact that the German judge understood what I said. He first spoke to my attorney in German, and then in English. He said, never mind, I'll talk to your client myself. He said, do you have an objection to the way we're running this court? And I told him I did. And I explained to him that I was a businessman. I have done nothing wrong. They were applying the law to me retroactively, and of course they can do that under the Napoleonic Code, because at the time I spoke, the Lucha Report had been declared a scientific document by the Minister of Science. He subsequently was removed from office, and the document was then banned. But this was 8 or 9 months after I spoke on it. Well, at any rate, the judges listened to me, and they said, will you return? And I said, yes, I would be more than happy to return and face trial. They made bail, which was approximately $20,000 U.S., and I immediately left. And it seems I left just in time, because the prosecuting attorney was on vacation that day, and the deputy prosecutor was there, and I guess he was somewhat incompetent. When the prosecutor returned, unbeknownst to myself and my lawyer, he managed to get the three judges that gave me the bail. He managed to have them removed from office. They issued an arrest warrant for a fugitive from justice, and I revoked my bail. Well, almost a year went by, and when the date came back that I was supposed to return, I was preparing to go back. And I was notified by an attorney who represented one of the inmates waiting trial in Mannheim. And he told me that I should not return. It was a message from one of the inmates, and I was told that my bail was revoked, a fugitive warrant had been issued, and there was a contract out to take my life within the prison. And when I returned, I was immediately going to be in prison because I had jumped bail. So I told my lawyer this, and I said, I'm not going back. And he said, I don't think that's true, because he said, I should have been notified. At any rate, he appeared in court the following day, and when he got up to explain to the judges why I wasn't there, he didn't even have to start. The judges told him that there had been some confusion. He should have been notified, but my bail was revoked the day after I left. The three judges had been removed, and a fugitive warrant had been issued. And since this was the case, they felt that they couldn't, under the law, keep the bail, so they returned the bail. And I haven't returned since then. The warrant is still outstanding, and I would assume that if I get back to Germany, they're going to put me right back in Mannheim. And I faced 8 years for simply talking about the fact that I investigated the facilities, wrote the report for Canadian court, and testified in Canada.
Well, it's certainly good that the Allies won the Second World War and imposed democracy on Germany. We can't have too much of this free speech stuff. This is Paul Fromm for Radio Freedom talking to Fred Lucher. I'd like to continue with your story. You'd been to Germany. You found yourself charged with this, to our way of thinking, ridiculous-sounding charge of defaming the memory of the dead for presenting your scientific findings, and you were unable to go back to Germany. Otherwise, you would face perhaps assassination or certainly a prison term. After you returned to the United States, were you the subject of pressure because you testified at the Zindel trial?
Yes, for the even before I had been imprisoned in Germany. I was being persecuted in Boston, where I lived. I was brought up on charges of practicing as an engineer without a license, and that's not a requirement in the state of Massachusetts. I was in the city of Malden, where I lived, and that's where the district court was. And for 4 months, there were, every time I went to court, there were riots outside the courthouse. They had every police officer that was available in the area surrounding the courthouse. And the day we were going to finally get a decision from the judge, and the judge had the prior week indicated to my attorney, who was not a Massachusetts attorney, I had three Massachusetts attorneys that were threatened, and they had backed out of the case. But the attorney that I had was from out of state, and he was helped by the judge. He was told about the Massachusetts Constitution and where they had no right to do this. And when we got back into court, he said, I think you better appeal this right now and take it to Cambridge. And my lawyer said, well, maybe we can do that. And I said, we've already passed the time of appeal. We should have appealed 2 months ago. And the judge said, I'll waive the time. I don't want to make a decision on this thing. So it was moved to Superior Court in Cambridge, which is the county seat for Middlesex County, where I lived. And after some 3 months there, we went to court, and the judge called in my attorney and the district attorney and said, we want this thing settled. I do not want it tried, and both parties are going to be very sorry if I have to make a decision on this. So at that point, my attorney worked out a deal with the district. That is not correct. There was what they call a pretrial probation, which is a contract or a promise between all the parties. And I agreed under the terms of the contract never to identify myself as a licensed engineer. Of course, I never did that in the first place, so it didn't make any difference. And I also agreed that for the next 2 years, I could not issue any reports on Auschwitz. Well, I didn't plan to do that again either, because I only did that for the court. So I simply said I wouldn't do anything that I didn't normally do anyway. And the district attorney was very upset about it, because he was being pressured by the Jewish organizations to prosecute. But I do share the distinction of being the only man ever indicted in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts for practicing as an engineer without a license.
Did the pressure on you from Jewish organizations and others affect your business?
Yes, my business as an engineer was totally destroyed. The prison wardens and officials at the institutions that I dealt with were afraid to deal with me because of political ramifications. In two states, Jewish legislators threatened to pass laws that prevented the Department of Correction from dealing with me. I was threatened. My life, my family, was also threatened. My house was firebombed at one point. And in the final analysis, after I had returned from Germany, I decided to keep a low profile because they had threatened close friends and close family members. So at that point, I decided to take a job elsewhere. And I'm extremely difficult to employ, because anybody who is willing to hire me faces the risk of having to deal with the Jewish organizations.
As a person who backs freedom of speech, I find particularly repugnant that the way some groups choose to debate is not to attack your facts, your methodology, but to try to destroy your life and your livelihood. I'd like to move closer to the present. A couple of years ago, a movie appeared called Mr. Death, if I were right, and it focused on your your life. Started off going through your somewhat unusual occupations, being an expert in execution methods, and how you developed that expertise, and so on. And then the second part dealt with your trip to Auschwitz and testimony to the Zundel trial, and then it featured a number of people attacking you. Can you tell us why you consented to be part of that documentary, and how you felt about the final result?
Yes, the gentleman who did the documentary, his name was Errol Morris. He came to me And he asked me if I would be willing to allow him to make a film. He had done a lot of research, and he found that I was a very much persecuted individual. He wanted to do a documentary in much in the style of President Kennedy's Profiles in Courage. Now, one of the things that was unique about his films is that they only have one person in them, just the person involved. He made a contract with me, and that's what he was supposed to do. He completed the film, and he expected to win an Academy Award for the film. And had he not changed it, he would have won the Academy Award. It was rejected out of hand when they saw what he had done to the film. The film was originally supposed to be shown on Bravo on television, and they didn't show it as well because of the problems. But what he did was he showed it initially, the first cut, before it went to the Sundance Film Festival at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And the people coming out were polled, and they said, gee, it seems like Fred Lucha knows what he's talking about. Maybe there weren't any gas chambers in Poland. Well, a red flag went up with the Jewish organizations, and an architect named Van Pelt was sent in to talk with Errol Morris, and they twisted his arm, and they threatened him a bit. And in the final analysis, he made a second film, and he piggybacked the second film onto the first film, in which he added a lot of other people, stating the other side of the issue. And in the final analysis, he destroyed the film, because the film looks like two films stuck together. So he ruined his film. I was not happy with it, but there was not a lot I could do because he made the film. He wasn't able to market the film the normal way he expected. He sold it to Lionsgate Productions, and it wound up in Blockbuster Video being sold, and anybody can buy a copy of it. He titled the film Mr. Death to avoid confusion with Dr. Kevorkian, who is known as Dr. Death. Originally, before Dr. Kevorkian had come on the scene, I had been dubbed Dr. Death by ABC News. And they made a documentary that was on Primetime Live. And Errol Morris didn't want the confusion, so he changed the name to Mr. Death, even though it originally had been slated to have been Dr. Death.
I haven't taken a scientific survey of people who've seen this, but a number of people I know across North America have seen Mr. Death, and I know it's come out in a number of different versions, too. I wasn't aware of the first version, but even of the second version, there's versions of that. But I would say a majority of the people I've talked to thought that you came across as a very human, sincere, likable, maybe misguided person, but that you did not come across as a monster, and that some of the people attacking you in the film seem very shrill, hysterical, and a bit unstuck. I share that with you. It's a very unscientific series of reactions. How did you feel about it?
This is the way I've always been attacked. My work apparently has been unassailable. At least they didn't have anybody competent enough to raise any question. So they always wind up doing a personal attack. And the unfortunate thing about this whole issue is that because they wanted to destroy me and my reputation to hopefully deflate the value of the report, they caused a problem where I couldn't deal with the prisons. And the prisons and the inmates that are being executed today, many of them, and it's available in any newspaper, you can see when the executions are done, many of them have been tortured to death. And I only became involved in the manufacture of execution equipment to prevent this because there was no one making it and the equipment was old, antiquated, and improper. And that's not happening anymore. They're still using the same old equipment, and they just generally don't know how to use it.
This is Paul Fromm for Radio Freedom. I'm talking with Fred Lucher, and before we conclude our time together, I want to ask you, you've kept a low profile for a number of years, and here we are in mid-June 2001 at the Barnes Review Conference in Washington, D.C., and you made a guest appearance. Are you planning to assume a more public role?
I'm not sure about that, but as I had indicated, I took a low-profile role originally because of all the threats, and I thought that others were going to be in danger. Some of that, in fact, all of that seems to have died down. And Willis Cardo was kind enough to ask me to come to the conference, and I thought about it, and the gentleman that I work for, I had to speak with him and get permission because I have to be concerned about whether or not he's going to have problems. And he thought that things had progressed enough so there would not be a problem, and he gave me clearance to go. So I may well be at the third annual conference as well.
Science is a strange thing. When discoveries are made, people often violently reject the findings. People wanted to lynch Darwin in his time. They thought he was anti-God. He wasn't, of course, but the people feared the meaning of evolution. And certainly, my guest this evening, Fred Lutcher, is one of those rare scientists whose findings will make a difference. People may not like the results. They may not like some of the conclusions that are drawn from your findings. But it's been a pleasure to have you on Radio Freedom. This is Paul Fromm for Radio Freedom in Washington.
For an audio tape copy of this show and two others of your choice, send a $5 donation to 152 Carlton Street, Suite 545, Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Postal code M5A2KO.